This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents Lost Hills by Lee Goldberg, performed by Nicole Zanzarella. Chapter 1. The northern stretch of Mulholland Highway ended in a T intersection with Mulholland Drive. It was an intersection that generated lots of confusion, and not only because of the nearly identical street names. It was also the intersection of two cities, three neighborhoods, two law enforcement jurisdictions, and on this hot, smoggy Thursday afternoon in December, life and death. Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department homicide detectives Eve Ronan and Duncan Pavone headed to that intersection. They were driving east on Mulholland Drive in a plain-wrap Ford Explorer to investigate a possible homicide called in by the LAPD.
"There's only one reason the LAPD would call us on a corpse," Duncan said, sitting in the passenger seat and wiping donut crumbs from his big belly, which he used like an airplane tray table. "To tell us that it's on our side of the line and not theirs."
Jurisdictional disputes were inevitable given the geography. The sheriff's department was responsible for law enforcement in Malibu, the Santa Monica Mountains, and the surrounding communities of Westlake Village, Agora Hills, Hidden Hills, and Calabasas. It was an enforcement area bordered by Ventura County to the west and northwest, the city of Los Angeles to the east and northeast, and Santa Monica Bay to the south. The intersection of Mulholland and Mulholland on the northern lowlands of the Santa Monica Mountains was the boundary between the Woodland Hills section of Los Angeles and the city of Calabasas. Eve had only been in the robbery-homicide division and working out of the Lost Hills station in Calabasas for 3 months, and this was her first encounter with a jurisdictional dispute. She was keenly aware of what she didn't know, and so was everybody else around her. "How do you resolve the situation if it isn't clear-cut?" Eve asked, even though she knew the question would reinforce the low opinion that Duncan and the other detectives already had about her qualifications for the job. But getting the knowledge was more important to her than her image.
"You piss, moan, and argue that the corpse is on their side, or that the crime happened there. You get out a tape measure to prove where the boundary is, or who has the bigger dick. You use whatever dirt you have on them, whatever favors they owe you, whatever leverage you've got, to make them take the body and the aggravation that comes with it," Duncan said. "But I almost always end up taking the body because I'm a softie."
She took her eyes off the road to give him an incredulous look. "You care that much about some LAPD cop having a bad day?"
"Hell no," Duncan said. "I do it because the victim deserves a cop who will work the case instead of one who is more intent on figuring out how some poor bastard who got shot 4 times in the back and got dumped on the jurisdictional line can be written off as a suicide."
Eve smiled to herself. Maybe she was lucky to get partnered with a guy on his way out who didn't give a damn anymore. At least he had once, and that counted for something. They made an odd-looking couple. He was old and fat and had a creative comb-over to hide his thinning hair. She was young and slim, her brown hair cut into a practical bob. They could be mistaken for a father and daughter who liked to carry Glocks. At the intersection of Mulholland and Mulholland, there were some houses to the north, a two-story office building on the western corner behind a line of pines, and a wooded patch of oaks to the east that ran through the hillside between a private school and a housing tract. Eve turned right onto Mulholland Drive, heading southbound, and saw a black and white parked behind a pickup truck on the side of the road. An LAPD plain-wrap Crown Vic was parked across the street, facing north. Two detectives leaned against their car, chatting with a uniformed officer. The detectives looked like they'd taken advantage of the buy-one-get-one-free sale at Men's Warehouse and split the cost to get the off-the-rack suits they were wearing.
"The two suits are Detectives Frank Knobb and Arnie Prescott out of Canoga Park," Duncan said as she parked behind the black and white. "Our paths have crossed a few times. Between the two of them, they've been around as long as I have."
Eve appreciated that Duncan didn't use the opportunity to mention yet again that she wasn't born when he'd first pinned on his badge. Duncan got out, hiked up his pants, waited for a car to pass, then crossed the street to speak to the detectives. Eve went over to check out the truck, which was covered with pine needles. The windshield was spattered with blood from the inside, and a body was slumped in the driver's seat.
"Hey, Dunkin' Donuts,"
one of the detectives said as Duncan approached them.
"How's it going?"
"Counting the days, Frank," Duncan said. "Another 163 and I'm out of here. Have you heard about my new partner, Detective Ronan?"
The two LAPD detectives looked over at Eve, who was still across the street studying the truck.
"Death Fist," Frank Knob said. "Sure, she's a legend."
Eve was previously a deputy out in Lancaster and unknown to anybody on the LAPD or anywhere else. But 4 months ago, while off duty, she witnessed actor Blake Largo, who starred as the invincible action hero Death Fist in a globally successful string of movies, assault a woman in a restaurant parking lot. Eve confronted him. He took a swing at her, and she put him on the ground. She pressed his million-dollar face to the pavement until police arrived. A bystander got it all on video with his phone and uploaded it to YouTube. The video got 11 million hits in less than a week. Now everybody called her Death Fist. So she ignored Knob's snide remark and focused her attention on the driver of the truck. His head lolled back on the headrest. His throat was slit and the jagged cut gaped open like an obscene, bloody smile. A Rambo knife lay on the passenger seat. She thought it might be a suicide, considering that the knife was right beside him and the largely residential, very safe neighborhood where the victim was found. But if it was suicide, he'd picked an odd place to end his life. The last thing he saw as he bled out was Gelson's, an upscale supermarket. Then again, Gelson's was heaven to some people.
"You're shitting me," Arnie Prescott said, studying Eve. "A viral video is all it takes at the sheriff's department to step up from burglary to homicide?"
It had more to do with the timing of the video, which came out amid revelations that sheriff's deputies were beating prisoners at the county jail. The enormous positive PR she got was a welcome distraction from the scandal and encouraged the embattled sheriff to keep her at the top of the news cycle for as long as possible. He did that by showering her with accolades, which included offering her a promotion. What she wanted was a transfer to robbery homicide, and she got it, making her the youngest woman ever in the division. The public and the media loved it. The rank and file at the LASD, primarily the 86% of them who had testicles, did not.
"The sheriff's department doesn't have the LAPD's high standards," Knob said. "No wonder you're crashing out now," Prescott said to Duncan.
Duncan didn't argue the point.
"What's the story on the dead man?" "A jogger spotted the body and called 911, Knob said. "The operator called the LAPD. This fine young patrol officer showed up, saw the guy was not merely dead, but most sincerely dead, and brought us in." "What this officer failed to notice in all the excitement was the boulder."
Prescott pointed to the median, where a newly installed boulder sat in a bed of flowers with the words, "Welcome to Calabasas," and a soaring bird decoratively carved on its north face.
"And which side of the boulder the truck was parked on?"
Knob grinned at Duncan.
"Your side."
Sure enough, the truck was parked a few feet south of the invisible city limits line, conveniently demarcated by the boulder, putting it in Calabasas. Eve looked at the road on the Los Angeles side, and her anger flared. She didn't like being played. The uniformed officer shrugged sheepishly.
"My bad."
"So, here you are," Prescott said.
"Lucky us," Duncan said with a weary sigh.
"We stuck around to secure the scene as a professional courtesy," Knob said.
"Really?" Eve said. The two LAPD detectives looked at her like a naughty child who'd spoken up while the adults were talking. because I thought securing the scene meant making sure it wasn't disturbed.
It doesn't look disturbed to me,
Nob said. The truck is covered with pine needles, Eve said. It obviously spent the night parked under a pine tree, which is odd since the nearest one is down at the corner in Los Angeles. Prescott snorted.
You ever heard of wind?
She stared at the detectives, not bothering to hide the disgust on her face. So why aren't there any pine needles on the sidewalk or the street around the truck? The two detectives maintained eye contact with her, but the uniformed officer looked away. Duncan shook his head at the two remorseless detectives.
It's your case, and as a professional courtesy, we're not gonna tell anybody about this little stunt.
Duncan hiked up his pants and shifted his attention to the officer.
But I want you to think about something, son. If forensic issues end up torpedoing their case, do you think these two will have your back or make you the fall guy? I'd protect my ass if I were you.
Duncan walked back across the street and gestured to Eve to follow him back to the car. Eve got into the driver's seat, started up the car, made a U-turn around the median, and then a right back onto Mulholland Drive, heading east. Eve assumed the detectives had pulled rank and ordered the officer to push the truck over the line. The officer's patrol car had welded steel bars on the front bumper that would enable him to move the truck without damaging his own vehicle. Who are they trying to screw by moving the body over the line into Calabasas? Eve asked. You or me?
Let me give you some advice. I know you're used to being the center of attention, but when shit happens to you, it isn't always personal.
What's that supposed to mean? They intended to screw us.
No, not us. All Nob and Prescott knew was that two LASD detectives were going to show up. They didn't know it was going to be the hotshot who didn't deserve her promotion and the old fat ass on his way out the door.
She nodded. So they're just lazy assholes.
That's right. It's nothing personal.
Duncan reached for the mic and let the dispatcher know that the body was in Los Angeles and that the LAPD was taking the case. The dispatcher immediately responded with a new call for them, a possible person down at a home on a cul-de-sac in Topanga, which was only a few miles southeast of their current location. Reporting party Alexis Ward says the resident failed to show up for work and doesn't answer her phone. The RP looked in a window and saw blood, believes the resident is inside, perhaps injured. 22 Paul 7, fire and paramedics are en route. You're clear, code 3.
Copy, Duncan said. 22 David 1. Rolling from Mulholland Drive and Topanga Canyon.
Chapter 2. Topanga Canyon Boulevard was a wooded two-lane road that snaked up into the Santa Monica Mountains, then down alongside a mostly dry creek bed to the Pacific Coast Highway. For Eve, it was a road into the past. It was a different way of life up here, rustic and isolated, still rooted in the beatnik and hippie cultures of the mid-20th century. But that lifestyle was facing extinction as seclusion-seeking celebrities and high-tech millionaires moved in, co-opting the culture as a retro design aesthetic and personal fashion statement, wearing their faux tie-dyed t-shirts as they drove their Bentley convertibles to brunch at the Inn of the Seventh Ray. For airport limo drivers and people who lived in the San Fernando Valley, Topanga Canyon was just a way to get into West LA without using the 405. Deep into the canyon, she took a left onto a narrow country road with a disintegrating asphalt that followed the southern slopes of Topanga State Park. The homes were few and far between, most of them ramshackle bungalows and 70s-era ranch houses, with a handful of new gated estates sprinkled among them. The road ended in a cul-de-sac that abutted a steep wooded hillside. At the end of the court was a poorly maintained, unfenced ranch home with two cars in the driveway, an old Ford Taurus with oxidized paint, and a Nissan Sentra. A woman in her early 30s paced anxiously in front of the house.
She's keyed up, Duncan said as Eve pulled up to the driveway. You better talk to her, woman to woman.
Good idea, because you know we don't even have to speak to each other, Eve said, putting the car into park. Our uteruses can communicate telepathically.
I think the correct term is uteri.
The two detectives emerged from the car. Duncan took a notebook from his back pocket as they approached the woman. Eve noticed that the notepad was curved by his buttocks. Eve flashed her badge.
I'm Detective Eve Ronan, and this is Detective Duncan Pavone with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Are you the woman who called 911?
Alexis Ward, she said, nodding, her voice cracking just a bit with concern.
You've got to get in there. Something's wrong.
We will, but we need more information before we can bust in, Eve said.
Who lives here?
Tanya Kenworth. That's her Taurus, just like her sign. Mine, too.
Alexis touched her necklace. A silver bull's head dangled from the thin chain.
We're astrological sisters, both born in April. I think that's why we became friends the instant we started waitressing together at Rockney's.
Oh, yeah, up on Canaan, Duncan said. I thought you looked familiar. I go there a lot. They've got great tri-tip.
Tanya was supposed to pick me up at 6 this morning to make our 7 o'clock call time at Paramount, Alexis said. She'd never miss that. Never.
Call time?
Duncan asked, looking up from the notes he was jotting on his pad.
When we're supposed to be on set for hair and makeup, we're extras on Grey's Anatomy. I went to the set on my own, but I must have left 100 voicemail and text messages for her. I came here as soon as we wrapped the scene I was in.
Eve asked, does Tanya live here alone?
She's got 2 kids, Caitlin and Troy, Alexis said. They're 10 and 7. This is her boyfriend's house, but she's moving out as soon as she can find a place.
Eve felt the muscles in her shoulder tighten up, a common reaction to stress, specifically the kind caused by her mother. This house was a dead ringer for her childhood home in Encino, and Tanya sounded just like her mom. A single mother on the fringes of Hollywood trying to raise 3 kids. She rolled her shoulders to loosen them up.
Does he know that?
Oh, yeah, she said. It got ugly. That's why I was worried when I couldn't reach her. What if he hurt her? What if she's inside there right now, bleeding to death, while we're out here talking?
The pitch of Alexis's voice increased as she spoke, and Eve held up her hands in a halting gesture to calm her down.
Okay, wait right here. We'll go check things out.
You told the 911 operator that you peeked in the kitchen window and saw blood. Where was that?
Back of the house, Alexis said.
At that moment, a sheriff's department patrol car rolled up behind their Explorer, and 2 uniformed deputies, Tom Ross and Eddie Clayton, got out. Ross was an ex-Marine, and everything about his body language screamed military. He could be dressed as Santa Claus and it wouldn't fool anyone. People called Clayton Shades because he almost never took off his wraparound sunglasses. Duncan waved them over.
Stay with Ms. Ward, will ya? The fire department will be here in a minute. Tell them to sit tight.
Eve and Duncan walked into the backyard. Some rusting lawn furniture, a deflated soccer ball, and a torn standing umbrella were strewn amid the dead grass and weeds. My mom was an extra, Eve said, surprising herself by volunteering the information to Duncan. They're human set dressing, decoration like a couch or a potted plant. The thing is, they're hoping to be discovered by somebody when their job is not to attract any attention at all.
Was your mother discovered?
Nope, Eve said as they approached the door and the kitchen window. But she still hasn't given up hope. Eve and Duncan peeked in the window, which was over the sink, and saw a pool of blood in the center of the yellowed linoleum floor. Bloody drag marks ran out into the hallway.
Shit,
Duncan said.
She looked at him.
Exigent circumstances?
In the absence of a search warrant, in order to enter the house, they needed credible grounds to believe that immediate action was necessary to save a person's life, prevent evidence from being destroyed, or stop a suspect from escaping.
Exigent as it gets, Duncan said.
Both of the detectives drew their guns. He gestured to her to take the lead. She tested the doorknob. It was locked. She took a step back and kicked the door open. The first thing Eve noticed was the strange smell. She'd been expecting the oddly metallic scent of blood. Instead, the odor evoked the ridiculous image in her mind of an overchlorinated swimming pool in a mechanic's garage. It didn't make sense, but she couldn't think about that now. She cleared her mind and moved into the kitchen, careful not to step in any of the bloody smears. Duncan moved off to one side, his eyes on the hallway, and gestured her forward with a nod of his head. "Police!" Eve shouted. "Is anybody here?" The house was quiet, the air still, in sharp contrast to the story of violence illustrated in blood on the floor and in the spatter she saw on the cupboards. But the dark energy generated by the violence was gone. Now all she felt was the emptiness, the vacancy of anything living besides her and Duncan. Duncan took a covering position as Eve edged around the doorway into the hall. The shag carpet was soaked with blood, and there were crimson streaks on the wall. The story was getting more horrific with each step they took. "This is the police," Eve said loudly and firmly. "If there's anybody in this house, you need to come out now, hands in the air." Nobody appeared. The only sound Eve heard was her own breathing. Eve and Duncan shared grim looks and moved slowly into the living room. The front door was spattered with blood, and two children's backpacks were lying in dried puddles of blood on the floor. Eve felt a pang of fear in her chest for the children. She hoped that they were in school or at a friend's house, anywhere but here. "Tanya? Caitlin? Troy, if you're hiding, it's safe to come out now," Eve said. "We're the police. You're safe with us." The house remained deathly quiet. The only people moving here were the two of them, but that didn't mean they were alone. She scanned the rest of the room. There was a bed pillow, a blanket, and a sheet on the couch, which faced a flat-screen TV that was way too big for the room. A small dog bed with a chewed-up Nylabone in it was against one wall. Where was the dog? Eve turned and looked back down the hall, where trails of blood led into three different doorways. Flies were coming into the house now, buzzing loudly past her ears. She looked at Duncan, and he nodded. Eve followed one of the blood trails into a bedroom, while Duncan went into the bedroom across the hall. She stood in the doorway, taking in the pink walls and the blood spatter on the shelves of dolls and stuffed animals. Eve moved into the room, eased around the blood-soaked carpet, and bumped into a standing electric fan, nearly knocking it over. She crouched down and peered under the bed. The lifeless eyes of a stuffed bear stared back at her. Eve rose, crossed the room, and opened the sliding, mirrored closet door with the toe of her foot. A young girl's clothes hung from the rod, including a princess gown, probably from Halloween. Eve's sister, Lisa, 3 years younger than her, once had a costume like that. "Clear!" Eve shouted and went back to the hall. Duncan emerged from what appeared to be Troy's room. There were toy cars on the floor and Marvel superhero posters on the walls. Eve's little brother, Kenny, 5 years younger than her, liked superheroes too when he was a kid, but only the DC ones, like Superman and Batman. "Clear," Duncan said. They moved in unison, following a blood trail to the next open doorway. It was the bathroom, and there was blood everywhere, as if someone had heaved buckets of it into the room, especially in the bathtub. Every surface was splashed or splattered with blood, even the ceiling. Eve's own blood went cold, chilling her from the inside out, goosebumps rising on her flesh. The flies had found the room, too, and their buzzing seemed amplified, as if channeled through loudspeakers, but she knew it was all in her head. There were blood-soaked dish sponges and several blood-smeared bottles of Clorox on the counter and in the sink. The smell of cleanser and motor oil was overpowering and, combined with the bloody tableau, repulsive. She fought her gag reflex, willing her muscles to relax. She would not humiliate herself and contaminate the crime scene by vomiting.
"My God," Duncan said.
Somehow, hearing his shaky voice was reassuring and helped her maintain control. He was as disturbed by this as she was. They backed away from the bathroom and eyed the two remaining doors, both ajar, both at the end of bloody trails on the carpet. Eve took the door on the left and Duncan took the one on the right. Eve stepped into the master bedroom. The bedding was missing from the king-size bed. The blood-soaked mattress was hacked to shreds, and the headboard was speckled with blood. She crouched down, peered under the bed, saw nothing but a pair of women's slippers and a small marijuana pipe, then moved to the closet, nudging it open with her shoe. It was filled with clothes belonging to a man and woman, but nobody was inside. "Clear," Eve said, and returned to the hallway. The other door was open to the garage. Duncan came back in, holstering his weapon.
"The garage is empty, but there are some drops of blood leading to where a car must have been parked."
Eve swallowed back some bile and cleared her throat. "Have you ever seen anything like this before?" Duncan shook his head.
"Thanks a lot."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"If we'd taken the dead guy in the truck, Crockett and Tubbs would have got this call,"
Duncan said, referring to the other team of homicide detectives at the station.
"But you had to point out the pine needles."
Duncan marched back to the kitchen and out into the backyard, where he stopped to get some fresh air. Eve followed him out and stood beside him, neither of them visible to the deputies, Alexis Ward, or anybody else in the cul-de-sac. After a long moment, Duncan spoke again.
"There's going to be a shitload of desk work and legwork on this case."
"Yeah, I get it," Eve said, irritated. "The other case would have been a lot less trouble."
"That's not what I meant. I'll take the desk, you take the street."
She looked at him. "You're the senior detective, you should take the lead."
"I just did by dividing the workload."
It took her a second to figure out his angle. "You're making me the face of the investigation."
"And the first set of eyes," he said. "My sight isn't so good anymore. I missed those pine needles, didn't I?"
"That's not it," she said. "What's the real reason you're putting me in the spotlight?" He sighed and glanced back at the house.
"This case is going to get very big and very ugly very fast. It won't make or break my career, and I sure as hell don't need more nightmares to take with me into retirement."
He was telling her, honestly and directly, that he was done. Eve respected him for that and didn't blame him for his decision. He'd put in his time. It was going to be her neck and soul on the line from now on.
"Okay," she said. "I'll call in CSU and get a warrant started," Duncan said. "You should find out what you can about the kids and the boyfriend."
She nodded. The enormity of what she was taking on was beginning to sink in, and it left her momentarily at a loss for words. Something awful had happened in that house, and it was going to be her job to find out what it was, seek some measure of justice, and live with the horrors that were revealed. She took a deep breath, put on her best poker face, and walked with Duncan to the front of the house. Chapter 3. An ambulance and fire truck had arrived, and the first responders were standing around waiting for instructions. Alexis ran up to Eve.
"What's wrong? Is she in there?"
"Nope," Eve said. "The house is empty."
"What did you see?"
"Same thing you did," Eve said. Alexis looked relieved, but that was only because she hadn't seen all the blood beyond the kitchen.
"So where's Tanya?"
"I don't know," Eve said, feeling guilty. Nothing that she'd said to Alexis was a lie, but it was all misleading. "Excuse me for a moment." Eve went over to the ambulance crew and the firemen. You can go. There's nobody home. She turned to Deputies Ross and Clayton, making sure her back was to Alexis and Duncan, and lowered her voice to a near whisper. Call in 2 more units. Freeze the scene. Nobody goes in or out except CSU. They nodded their understanding, and she went back to Alexis and Duncan, who had his curled pad out again and was making notes.
Where do Caitlin and Troy go to school?
He asked. Canyon Oaks Elementary, she said. Duncan glanced at Eve. He had what he needed to work with. Where is their father? Eve asked, taking over questioning and giving Duncan an out to go back to their SUV to start making calls.
Up in Merced. His name is Cleve Kenworth. He and Tanya divorced a few years ago. She doesn't talk about him.
Eve took out her pad from the inside pocket of her navy blue Ann Taylor blazer, one of 3 in the same style, but in different colors, that she bought online when she got her detective shield and hung up her uniform. What do you know about Tanya's boyfriend? The ambulance and fire trucks began backing out of the cul-de-sac, and that seemed to give Alexis some reassurance that things were going to be okay. Eve could see Alexis relaxing, her body loosening up.
He's an asshole, Alexis said.
Let's start with his name and his job and work our way up to the asshole part, Eve said. Alexis smiled, more evidence to Eve that she was calming down. Jared Rawlins, he's a grip, one of those guys who moves lights and carries stuff on movie sets. Eve knew what a grip was. Her sister's father was a grip who dated their mother for a few weeks. He came around to see Lisa at Christmas and on her birthday for a few years, then disappeared from their lives. Eve remembered his freckled face and calloused hands, and that he was nice. He had brought all 3 kids See's caramel lollipops when he came to visit Lisa.
What show is he on? Eve asked. He's a day player, something different all the time. Does a lot of stuff, movies, TV series, commercials, videos, an occasional porno.
What makes him an asshole?
The way he talks to Tanya, always putting her down. He hates the kids, too. He calls them rats like he's joking, but he's not.
Eve's father was like that, a journeyman TV director who never married but had fathered a lot of children, all with aspiring actresses and production assistants, and rarely paid a dime of child support. The few times Eve saw him during her early childhood was when her mother would bring her to family court in an effort to influence the judge. Now her dad lived in a bungalow at the motion picture and television Country House and Hospital in Woodland Hills, not even 5 miles from her condo or where she worked. But she'd never visited him.
Where's Jack's shit? Alexis asked, breaking into Eve's thoughts.
Excuse me? Eve said.
Their dog, an old Jack Russell Terrier Shih Tzu mix. He barks at everything. Did you see him?
No, we didn't. Eve had forgotten about the empty dog bed in the living room.
That makes no sense, Alexis said, stiffening up again. They'd never let Jack shit out of the house off leash. He'd be coyote bait.
I'll look into that. Eve waved to Deputy Clayton to come over and faced Alexis again. Thank you for everything, Ms. Ward. Please give the deputy your contact information before you go home. We'll be in touch as soon as we know something. Eve left Alexis with Clayton and went over to her SUV, where Duncan sat in the passenger seat holding a cell phone to his ear.
I'm on hold waiting to talk to the ADA about the warrant, he said. CSU is on the way, and I had dispatch send a patrol unit to Canyon Oaks to check on the kids. What did you learn?
The boyfriend's name is Jared Rawlins. He's a grip. Maybe his union can tell us where he's working.
If he's working, Duncan said. Could be he's in the wind.
Her ex-husband's name is Cleve, and he lives up in Merced, Eve said. All she knew about Merced was that it was a small town in central California, 275 miles north of Los Angeles. She'd never been there.
I'll contact Merced PD and get them to track him down, Duncan said.
The family dog is missing, too. Maybe it ran off when whatever happened in the house went down. Do you think we can get animal control to look for him? He looked at her, straight-faced.
Sure thing. They search for lost dogs all the time. That's what they do.
You're being sarcastic, she said. They'd only look for it if it was rabid, and even then I'm not so sure.
What do you think we'd get from the dog anyway?
Jack Shit, she said.
That's right.
That's the dog's name. Jack Shit. He's a Jack Russell Terrier Shih Tzu mix.
Adorable, Duncan said.
Eve knew that there was nothing to be gained from finding the dog. She just didn't like the idea of it being some coyote's dinner. I'll secure the scene for CSU, she said. She went to the rear of the Explorer, opened the back, took out a big roll of yellow crime scene tape from the trunk, and walked back to the house. She tied one end of the tape to a street light and walked the perimeter of the property, stopping every now and then to secure the tape around a tree, bush, lawn chair, or other object. As she walked, she kept her eyes open for anything out of the ordinary. It made her look busy while giving her an excuse to think about what she was taking on. Most of her investigative experience was in home and business burglaries. The few homicides that she'd worked were hardly big mysteries. One was an elderly man who killed his Alzheimer's-afflicted wife, then himself. Another was a homeless man who stabbed another homeless man in a dispute over scavenging rights to a dumpster behind a grocery store. This case was more complex than anything she'd tackled before. But what did she know? Only that a woman was missing and that some terrible violence had seemingly occurred in her house. There were no bodies. So was she dealing with a murder? Multiple murders? An abduction? It was way too soon to tell. Eve was in the backyard when she noticed a depression in the dry brush going from the dead lawn up into the grove of trees at the top of the hill. Someone or some animal had trampled through the weeds recently. Perhaps it was the trail left by the dog when it fled the house. She set down the roll of tape on a lawn chair and trudged up the hillside, creating a parallel path alongside the one that was already there so she wouldn't contaminate any possible evidence. The dirt was hard and the weeds were like hay. She stepped up into the trees and was surprised to see a rumpled sleeping bag on the ground, surrounded by trash from a McDonald's takeout meal. The sleeping bag wasn't soiled, dirty, or covered with leaves. She squatted beside the trash and looked at a pickle slice in a Big Mac carton. The pickle was still moist. This campsite hadn't been here long, maybe a day at most. She looked back the way she came. Whoever was here had a clear view of Tanya's house, front yard, and the cul-de-sac. She could see the crime scene unit van arriving. Had somebody been watching the house? If so, why and for how long? Did whoever it was have something to do with Tanya's disappearance and the violence? If not, did he see what happened? She was about to start taking pictures with her phone when a twig snapped behind her. She whirled around and at the same instant, some rampaging hairy monster, a grizzly bear, a werewolf, burst out of the trees and whacked her across the head with a rock. She felt a blinding explosion of pain and fell on her side. The enraged beast kicked her hard in the stomach, forcing the air out of her lungs. She couldn't breathe and instinctively curled into a fetal position, protecting her midsection. The beast kicked her in the head, and everything went dark. Chapter 4. Eve opened her eyes, cheek to the ground, her vision blurred, and immediately sucked in air, drawing in some dirt along with it. She coughed, breathed deeply again, and unfurled herself, her vision sharpening on a bit of chopped white onion just beyond her nose. Her head throbbed, and it hurt to breathe, but she didn't think she had any broken ribs. Her gun was pressing painfully against her side, pinned between her and the ground, but it was a good pain. It meant that whoever struck her hadn't taken her weapon and wasn't going to shoot her or somebody else with it. She sat up slowly, slightly dizzy. The sleeping bag and trash were gone, and so was whoever or whatever had attacked her. No, it was a whoever, She didn't believe in monsters, despite what she saw. Or thought she saw. Eve looked back down at the cul-de-sac. The CSU team was just emerging from their van, so she'd been out for only a minute or two. Bracing herself on a pine tree for support, she rose unsteadily to her feet. She touched the side of her head above her right temple where she'd been hit with the rock and kicked. Her hair was wet, and when she lowered her hand, she saw blood on her fingertips. Shit. She glanced around and spotted a rock a foot away with fresh blood on a sharp edge. He could have caved her head in with it, but didn't. She was lucky to be alive. Eve took a deep breath and, still shaky, started back down the hill, immediately lost her footing, and slid on her ass for a few feet. She sat still for a moment, feeling stupid, then got up slowly, brushed the dirt and weeds off herself, and tried going down the hill again, more carefully this time. She got down to the backyard without stumbling and headed for the Explorer. Duncan got out of the passenger seat when he spotted her and met her halfway.
"What the hell happened to you?" he said.
She knew how awful she looked. Her head was bleeding and her clothes were dirty. She wasn't off to a great start as lead detective. But she pressed on as if she was oblivious to it. Maybe that would make him ignore it too. "I was looking around up on the hill and came across a sleeping bag and some trash," she said and kept walking, Duncan keeping pace beside her. "Before I could take any pictures, someone hit me from behind and ran off with the stuff."
"Did you get a look at him?"
She wasn't going to tell him about the hairy beast. It was a crazy story that would go viral around the station and undermine any chance she'd ever have of establishing credibility. "No," she said, and reached into the Explorer's passenger door pocket for one of the napkins Duncan always kept there. He spilled a lot of stuff on himself. Duncan tipped his head toward the hill.
"That's Topanga State Park. It's crawling with the homeless. They can be fiercely protective about their things. He probably didn't realize you were a cop."
Whoever it was had a clear view of the house. She dabbed a napkin against her wound. The napkin came back red. "We need to talk to him."
"I'll send CSU up there to see what evidence they can find, and I'll get the park rangers to look for a guy in a hurry lugging a sleeping bag."
"Tell the CSU guys that the blood on the rock is mine." He squinted at her head.
"That's a nasty cut. You need to go to the ER.
"The hell with that." Eve balled up the napkin, stuffed it in her pocket, and went to the back of the SUV. She raised the tailgate, found her LASD baseball cap, and gently placed it on her head, neatly hiding the blood in her hair. "There, all better." Duncan stared at her. She stared back at him. It felt like an axe was cleaving her skull apart. "What?" she said. "Are you gonna tell me how often people who suffer head injuries but don't see a doctor afterwards die hours later from subdural hematomas?"
"I have no idea what you're talking about," Duncan said. "What I've got to tell you is that Tanya's kids didn't show up for school today."
She looked back at the house, thought about the two backpacks left by the door, and was filled with dread. Chapter 5. A half hour later, Eve and Duncan were still waiting on a warrant authorizing the CSU team to enter the house. There were two CSU techs up on the hill. The other four were laying down a paper carpet between the sidewalk and the kitchen door in preparation for going in. Eve's headache had ebbed, and she could feel that the baseball cap was stuck to the dried blood in her hair. She was antsy to get something done, so she gathered the half-dozen uniformed deputies at her SUV and addressed them as a group. "I need you to talk to the neighbors along the road. I know this house is isolated, but there's still a chance that somebody saw or heard something. Also, go to all of the trailheads for the Topanga State Park. Take down license numbers, makes, and models of any cars that are parked there. And talk to any hikers who come back. Ask them if they saw anything. Hold any guy you see carrying a sleeping bag." She looked back at Duncan, who sat in the SUV, the air conditioning running, his door open a crack.
Did I miss anything?
You covered it all, he said.
Then his phone buzzed. He answered it.
Okay, she said to the deputies. You've got your jobs. Bring your reports to me at the station.
The deputies nodded and headed off. A CSU tech in a Tyvek jumpsuit and booties approached Eve from the backyard. He was tall, very thin, and his Adam's apple was so big he looked like he was trying to swallow a baseball. His name was Lou Numis, and he was one of the two techs who'd gone up the hill.
Find anything up there? She asked.
Not really. I took some pictures and collected these.
Numis held up an evidence baggie containing dirt with one hand and another baggie with chips of bark in the other.
What for? She asked.
I smelled urine on the base of a tree, so I took a sample of the bark and dirt for the DNA.
How do you know it's human pee and not animal pee?
They smell different.
He started to bring the bags to her to sniff, but she shooed him away.
I'll take your word for it.
Duncan got out of the SUV and pocketed his phone.
We've got a warrant.
Eve, Duncan, and the CSU techs put Tyvek shoe covers over their footwear and rubber gloves on their hands. Nan Baker, the large African-American woman in her 40s who led the CSU, pulled the hood of her Tyvek suit over her hair, picked up her bag, and led the way down the paper carpet like a general going into battle. Eve went into the kitchen more slowly this time, paying closer attention to the details she missed on her first visit. The kitchen hadn't been updated in 20 years. The appliances were old and the countertops were granite tiles. She noticed an array of magnets on the front of the refrigerator. The magnets were from Domino's, Mr. Plunger, a gardener, and other restaurants and services, and held artwork by the kids, a school calendar, and discount coupons. A CSU tech stationed himself in the kitchen and began taking pictures of the blood. There was a purse on the floor that looked as if it had been dropped. Some of the contents, a roll of lip balm and a tiny bottle of Purell, had spilled out. Eve crouched beside the purse and used her pen to peek inside.
No cell phone, no house keys.
She teased out a keychain with a Ford logo from the purse and dangled it on the end of her pen.
But the car keys are here.
The CSU tech held out an open baggie to Eve.
Saves us the trouble of breaking into her car.
Eve dropped the keys in the bag, stood up, and followed Duncan into the living room. Another CSU tech was photographing everything. Duncan stopped and stared at the puddle of blood and the backpacks, and she knew what he was thinking. The children were either gravely injured or dead. Eve went to Caitlin's room and found Nan leaning close to a row of Barbie dolls that sat on the edge of a shelf, their legs crossed, blood spattered on their happy plastic faces.
What's your initial impression? Eve asked.
Nan straightened up and answered without looking at her.
People died here.
How many?
Certainly more than one, based on the amount of blood I can see, particularly the spatter patterns on the walls, indicating blunt force trauma or arterial spray, and multiple deep saturation stains on the carpets, indicating catastrophic blood loss. Come back in a few hours and ask me again.
Nan looked at her now.
We're going to be here processing this scene for a long time.
How long is long?
A couple of days, at least.
Someone outside called Eve's name. She turned and went back through the kitchen and out into the yard where Deputy Ross was waiting for her on the grass.
A guy just showed up in a truck, says he lives here, Ross said. His name is Jared Rollins.
Duncan joined Eve.
What's up?
The boyfriend is here, Eve said, not sure how to handle this new development.
He was an obvious suspect, given what they'd learned about him from Alexis. But if he was responsible for whatever violence had happened here, it was pretty ballsy of him to show up at the scene as it was being processed. She decided to let Jared's demeanor and Duncan's body language guide her tactics. Eve and Duncan peeled off their gloves and followed Deputy Ross back out to the cul-de-sac, where Deputy Clayton was standing in front of a dirt-caked Ford F-150 pickup, preventing it from going to the house. The man in the driver's seat had a deep tan, a day's growth of beard, and a military buzz cut to compensate for a receding hairline. Duncan approached the driver's side window, which was rolled down.
Mr. Rollins, I'm Detective Pavone, and this is Detective Ronan.
What the hell is going on? What are you doing in my house?
Step out of the truck and we can discuss it, Duncan said.
Jared sighed, shut off his truck, and got out. Eve looked him over. He was a muscled man and spent a lot of time outdoors. His tank top and cargo shorts were faded, and his chest and arms were as tan as his face and neck. There was dirt caked on his work boots.
Now are you going to tell me what the fuck is going on here? Jared said. Why can't I go into my own house?
His anger didn't make sense to Eve. Have you got a reason to be ticked off, Mr. Rollins?
Wouldn't you be if you came home to a bunch of cops who wouldn't let you in your house?
No, Eve said. The first thing I'd want to know is if Tanya and the kids are okay.
Why? She's at work and the kids are at school. The problem here is that something is happening in my house and I'm not being told what it is or let inside.
His anger was making a little more sense to Eve. The house had become a battleground for him, first with Tanya and now with the police. He wanted to assert his authority over what was his. The question Eve had now was how far he'd gone to assert it.
Tanya is not at work and the kids aren't in school, Duncan said. They're all missing.
That's what this big production is about? Jared laughed.
Jesus, it's nothing.
What makes you so sure? Eve said.
Because she's a flake. She could have woken up this morning, looked at the big blue sky, and decided, hey, it's a beach day. I'll just blow off everything and hit the sand with the kids. That's her. Whoever called you freaked out over nothing.
She freaked out over the blood, Eve said.
Blood? It's all over the place, Mr. Rollins, Duncan said. It looks like a butcher shop in there.
Jared stared at them for a long moment, studying their faces, adding something up in his mind.
You said Tanya and the kids are gone, right?
And the dog, too, Eve said.
So it's just blood, Jared said.
Duncan cocked his head, studying Jared now.
Just blood? Look, we're having some problems. I told her to move out. Maybe this is payback. Maybe she went batshit, tossed a bucket of pig blood all over the place, and hit the road.
That seems extreme, Eve said.
She's an actress, or at least she thinks she is. She turns everything into a major drama. She'd love all this attention.
Eve couldn't reject the possibility that he was right. But the spatter told her a tale of violence that wouldn't emerge from somebody simply splashing the blood around the house. And she had a hard time believing that Tanya would paint with the blood to create the impression of a terrible struggle. Even so, Eve forced herself to keep an open mind to all possibilities. Making any assumptions this early in the investigation could lead to tunnel vision that would prevent her from spotting any evidence that didn't reinforce her preconceptions. That was especially dangerous in the initial hours of an investigation. She'd learned that from books, not experience. Duncan took his pad out of his back pocket and clicked his ballpoint pen for action.
When was the last time you saw her and the kids?
Tuesday night before I went to bed. I left the house at 3 a.m. I had to get to Lancaster to start rigging the lights on a Kevin Costner Western that's being shot in the desert.
And you're just getting back now?
Eve said.
It was Thursday afternoon. I was bushed after shooting, so I spent the night in a motel. To be honest, I was looking forward to a big bed. I'm tired of sleeping on the couch.
It's your house, Duncan said. Why isn't Tanya on the couch?
Because I'm a fucking gentleman.
Eve saw that as an opening and took it. Then you won't mind being a gentleman and coming over to the Lost Hills station to answer some more questions for us.
Sure, Jared said.
Duncan said.
How about letting us take a look at your truck?
Jared dug the keys out of his pocket and handed them to Duncan.
No reason not to.
Thanks, we appreciate it.
Duncan tossed the keys to Deputy Ross, who caught them.
The deputy will give you a consent form to fill out and sign, authorizing us to search your vehicle. When you're done with that, we'll give you a ride to the station.
Will you throw in a wash?
Jared asked, amused with himself.
It's a search, Duncan said, not a detailing.
Jared shrugged and swaggered off with the deputy to a patrol car to fill out the form. Eve and Duncan watched him go. I didn't spot any suspicious cuts or bruises on his arms or legs that might indicate that he was in a struggle, Eve said.
Yeah, it was real nice of him to wear a tank top and shorts so we could see that.
It's what grips wear, she said. They do a lot of work outdoors.
It was also mighty convenient that he was on an out-of-town shoot while somebody was getting killed in his house.
She wasn't going to argue that, technically, they didn't know that anybody was dead. But then she remembered what Nan said. People died here.
You think he's responsible?
Eve said.
The fucking gentlemen usually are.
Chapter 6 The Lost Hills Sheriff Station was on Agora Road, which ran alongside the southern edge of the 101 freeway and straddled the dividing line between the small cities of Agora and Calabasas. Eve led Jared down the hall to one of the interrogation rooms.
Can I get you a Coke or something, Mr. Rollins?
Yeah, a Coke would be good, and a Snickers or Milky Way if you've got it. I'm starving.
I'll see what we've got. She pulled out a seat at the table for him.
Make yourself comfortable and we'll be right back.
Eve stepped out of the room, leaving the door open, and joined Duncan in the hallway, out of Jared's sight and earshot.
You interview him, Duncan said. I'll check his alibi.
Sure, Eve said. The two of them headed for the squad room, and they nearly collided with Captain Moffat. He was in his 40s and wore his uniform with so much starch that Eve imagined it was like wearing cardboard. The rigidity suited his personality. He'd recently replaced a captain who was fired for sexually harassing a female deputy, who'd since quit and filed a